Welcome to Heavy Networking, the show where the packet pushers chat with IT professionals the world over about networking. We go hard and heavy on routing, switching, and related services. Today, we chat with Cisco's Akshat Sharma to discuss some of the advanced features related to zero-touch provisioning on iOS XR in this sponsored episode. Why advanced ZTP? Because we already hit ZTP fundamentals back in weekly show episode 378. So if you want to, you know, learn the basics of zero-touch provisioning, go back to that show. Again, weekly show 378. In this show, we're going to hit a few ZTP basics just to refresh your memory and then talk through tooling to help with golden image creation, model-driven ZTP automation, the unique challenge of using ZTP to stand up access networks with lots of devices, and ZTP security. Akshat, welcome back to Heavy Networking for what I believe is your third appearance here. Good to have you back.
Thanks, Ethan. Thanks, Greg. Thanks for having me again.
Now, I mentioned at the intro there, we did hit zero-touch provisioning fundamentals for iOS XR in that episode 378. So, I mean, we don't need to go too deeply on the basics, but that said, can you just give us, to do some level setting for folks here, just a high-level overview of ZTP? What is it and what problem does it solve for me?
Absolutely. So the last time that we discussed ZTP, the focus was on basics of what ZTP is, when do people actually use it, what are the different use cases, etc. And if I touch upon that again, the basic idea is that there has been a shifting change in the way large-scale service providers and web-scale service providers, of course, look at operations, starting from the instance that the box rolls out from trucks and goes on to an installation site. And the primary goal there is to make sure that the entire truck to active rollout timeframe for a given device is reduced to as small a time frame as possible. And we've seen that from the numbers coming from some of the large web scale service providers, the amount of time they want to spend from a truck to active device is usually in a period of 15 to 30 minutes. And the only way something like that is actually possible is if you have devices that are plugging into a system that is automated to a large extent and allows a device to basically join the network and have its services activated without anyone touching it at all. And that is basically where zero-touch provisioning comes in. Like, how does a device that has absolutely nothing on it, no configuration, no way of anybody potentially accessing the device except for a console, be able to connect to a system, a set of devices, an infrastructure that basically allows the device to communicate with other elements within the network? And how does it get to a stage where it can start having a configuration and then relaying information such as monitoring data to other devices as needed? So in that respect, the router essentially is going to send out a DHCP request as soon as it boots up. And there are two stages that it can potentially go through. One stage would be where it tries to fetch an image in case the device is sent to the installation site without any image on it, right? So you could have a device where the disk is completely empty. It's not being provisioned within ISO. And in that sense, it will go through a couple of potential processes based on the type of device. So if you have a Cisco platforms that typically run iOS XR, these platforms would go through a process called iPixie, which is effectively the next generation version of Pixie that also allows Pixie to use HTTP and HTTPS for file downloads. And it can therefore go through an iPixie process by sending out a DHCP request, receiving an option 67 file name to indicate where it can download an image from. Mm-hmm. And once it gets the image, it will install it and then boot to a state where it can start running the next set of processes. And in this entire paradigm, of course, iPixie would be running on Cisco platforms. But when you consider white box platforms, and since we've made an announcement around XR running on select white box platforms for a certain set of customers, you can also have an only compatible installer image for iOS XR that can also be given to a device that runs only on boot, right? So these are the two potential options through which you could get an image installed on a device that has nothing on it.
So there's two things I take away from that intro that you've hit us with, Akshat, to just make sure I've got them right. First of all, the important one to note is this is iOS XR, which is that specific family of iOS, which is coming out of that part of Cisco, mainly focused around service providers, but used in a couple of different areas as well, I think. And the ZTP functionality is specific to iOS XR. And the second one is that ZTP is not only used to provision new devices, it's also a way to upgrade devices. So instead of doing like the old process of there's one operational tasking to set up new devices and there's another set of operational tasking to upgrade devices, those two become the same thing. Because whether it's an upgrade or a fresh, that's just how ZTP organizes it.
Right. So you're actually leading me into the part where I connect ZTP and IPXE typically. So it is not apparently clear to everyone when I talk about these as two separate processes, but you have to essentially consider when they kick off. So IPXE and ONI are effectively bootloaders, right? So they're trying to get an image installed on a given system and get it up and running to a state where it can actually run the next stage of processes that involve scripts or applying a config, etc. And the part that you refer to, which is potentially upgrading a device through this entire process, involves the state where a device already has an image and you're trying to get it to a new image by using something like IPXE or even ONI. And the idea there is that, let's say I've shipped a device with an image that's pre-installed during manufacturing and it's been sent out to a customer site. And the customer has already identified that even though there are a bunch of boxes coming in with, say, a release X, but they're actually looking to run a particular release Y, which may have either certain specific features or bug fixes that they need. Then in that case, they can set up their DHCP server to respond with instructions to install release Y, but the box has to actually request that in the first place, right? Mm. So if a box already has an installed image, it is simply going to boot up that image. So it doesn't go through
the process. But if I want to upgrade that image to the next version,
yes,
I don't have the problems that I used to have where, you know, the flash might be being re-architected or I had to have a boot image and then the final image and all those things change to a much simpler process.
Right. So what essentially happens here is that for a box that's coming with a pre-installed image, it will frankly just boot up and start with the ZTP process. And then what typically our customers do is that the ZTP script that is relayed back to the device has a small check at the beginning, which basically checks to see, am I running the particular version that I need, right? If I'm not, reboot into IPXE. And as it does that, the box goes back into IPXE and tries to fetch the image that has now been set up on the DHCP server. So in a sense, the ZTP process, which actually kicks off after the network OS is booted, is able to get the device back into IPXE mode so that it can upgrade to the new version. So in a sense, you've never actually reached a stage where the network OS is running install commands, for example, but instead you're using IPXE for the device to always boot to a particular version. So your upgrade cycle has now been intertwined with how you set up your DHCP web server and your entire ZTP IPXE paraphernalia.
Yeah, that's the gap. But I didn't quite get the difference between ZTP and IPXE. So thank you for clarifying that.
Now, Akshat, one of the topics I heard you present recently on was golden ISOs and golden ISO workflows. Now, we were just talking through that whole ZTP. Now, Greg, you got me wanting to say ZCP, but you got me.
That's the correct way.
Through that whole ZTP process, there can be some back and forth where you're loading an image and then you need to load more things, a configuration later, or perhaps load in some third-party applications. And you've been describing a golden ISO workflow that can help take some of the back and forth out of that process. So can you tell us what a golden ISO is and then some of the different types that we could create in the Cisco world?
Oh, absolutely. So before I start off on that, let me give some context to folks listening in on what are the different aspects of ZTP itself that are actually useful. When you start considering the ZTP process, as I mentioned earlier, this is the process that kicks off after the network OS has been installed and booted on the device. And ZTP is primarily used for a bunch of different functionalities, right? So you're looking at either applying a configuration, a static file, or deploying applications on the system once it boots up. These could be Linux applications, containers, binaries, etc. You can also look to potentially do the upgrade downgrade that we discussed earlier. And of course, be able to do whatever automation using the scripts that you're running on the box to provision through CLI, through Yang APIs that we'll discuss later as well. Now, these are the basic ZTP functionalities that we typically think of. When we consider the entire workflow, therefore, typically customers would select either a combination of IPXC and ZTP or just ZTP if they are happy with the image that the box comes burnt in with. And in all of these stages, there are, of course, a set of steps that have to be performed by the device to actually get to a service-activated state. Now, there are potentially pitfalls there because as with any code running in a production environment, things can go wrong, right? So a script that is required to run and get the device to the intended state may fail because in the end, the customer themselves is writing the script that needs to run on the device. And in addition to that, you could also have a situation where minor things could go wrong, like a web server connection is faulty, so it's not able to download the image. Maybe the processes are such that the ZTP process, even though it tries to run the image, are failing for some weird reason. Maybe there's a bug. Who knows, right? So there are different situations in which the ZTP process could potentially fail, and people have to be ready for that. As with any other process in large-scale deployments, you have to plan for failure. And in order to mitigate failure, some of the customers have started thinking about new type of paradigm where they do want to pre-provision the device without actually having to do it in a pre-staging facility. Like, you don't have to go ahead and boot up every device, try to put in the config through a console, make sure it works, and then ship the device to an installation site. Instead, let's try and eliminate the ZTP process and the script running process and focus only on the IPXC process for a bit. What you can do effectively with the golden ISO concept is that we've borrowed this concept from how servers actually run today using golden ISOs in public clouds as well. Whether you consider typical operating systems like Red Hat or Ubuntu, etc., you have a corresponding golden ISO tool for each of these operating systems. And the idea there is that you take a base ISO, which is the base image that's available for any of these operating systems to run. And this base image would have a set of features that you typically need, but you would usually add a bunch of more RPMs and packages on top of that system in order to get it to the state that you might need for your use case. And that's exactly the case with XR as well. We publish a base ISO with a minimal set of features on CCO, that is Cisco.com. Mm-hmm. And you can add your own configuration on top of it. You will then add a set of RPMs that we publish for XR features. For example, there's a separate RPM for multicast. There's a separate RPM for MPLS or MPLS-TE. And you can usually add these RPMs and install them on top of the running OS so that you can then apply the configuration for those set of features. Now, a ZTP script would generally do these steps for you. It'll run, it'll download these packages, install them, apply the required config, and then install other applications, etc., as part of its workflow. But the golden ISO basically allows you to do all of these steps off box during the creation of the image itself.
So who creates the golden ISO? Is that what we get from Cisco, or do we build some part of that ourselves?
Yeah, so there is actually an involvement from the customer side where they take a base ISO from the software downloads on Cisco.com. Mm. They take a golden ISO tool, or in short, GISO or GISO, that we publish on GitHub, and I'll provide a link for that. Mm. And they basically provide this base ISO as an input to the golden ISO tool. And the golden ISO tool effectively then packages up the base ISO as well as the set of RPMs that you point the golden ISO tool to as part of an RPM repo. And it is then able to put all of these RPMs, mount them inside the base ISO,
okay,
repackage it into a new version called the golden ISO.
So that means that that I can choose, or likely to choose, what elements are going to be in the iOS XR image, in that the sense that it's modular. And I can say, I want to load the OSPF and the BGP stack, or maybe I want ISIS and the BGP with MPLS. They're all containers that run inside of the iOS X. Well, I don't know if they're the exact containers, but that type of idea.
So they are modular components within XR where the features that they provide are tied to the RPMs installed on the system. So if you consider MPLS, MPLS team, multicast, etc., unless you have those RPMs activated, the features are not available for you to use. These are for various reasons, particularly for folks who are looking to run only the set of features that they need. And we focused on this concept for quite a while on XR. And in fact, in upcoming releases, you'll see more and more focus on modularity as part of the basic architecture. And the idea here is that these steps that would have been typically performed as part of the ZTP process can now be done off box by you creating a golden state of the ISO that you need by simply packaging these RPMs beforehand. So you don't have to rely on a ZTP script actually installing these packages in production.
Akshat, now we're talking about all Cisco components here, the Cisco OS and the Cisco RPMs that provide the XR functionality that we're looking for this particular device. But I mean, there's third-party tools that I could install on my iOS XR router as well. Is that also supported by the GISO tool?
Right. So the GISO tool is basically in an evolving state. We've pushed out the first version of the GISO tool, which is on GitHub, and you can see what it actually looks like. And it basically goes ahead and packages iOS XR RPMs today and can also package a predefined configuration into the system so that when the system boots up, it will have the required packages active and it'll also have the required configuration to get the device to a particular state. The next version of the tool that we are planning to bring out fairly soon is basically going to be able to allow you to run third-party applications when the box boots up itself. And the way to do that is twofold, right? You can have either binaries, applications that you've compiled for the WinRiver Linux distribution that XR is running. And in that case, we have several examples of these where you can create your own RPMs to run natively on the system. And in the next version of the tool, you'll be able to basically provide your third-party application RPMs as another input to the Golden ISO tool, and it will simply install it in the right location. The second possibility is using containers. Now, container images, of course, are a distinct rootfs that has to be placed inside the system and then booted at launch. Of course, it is slightly distinct in the sense that the directive to launch a container needs to come as part of the system boot process. And therefore, as we allow people to bring their container rootfs and package it into the ISO as part of the Golden ISO tool process, you can also specify, just like any other Linux system, you can specify a service that needs to run at boot that will basically launch the container for you. So a couple of files when you're trying to put containers as part of your boot workflow, where you will have to package not only the container rootfs, but also a service that needs to run as part of the boot process. And in the current version of XR, we use initd services as a lot of other Linux systems do. We will be moving to systemd in the future. So that is the sort of preparation you will have to do in order to create both a service and a rootfs in order to boot the container at the start time.
So, you would be able to do a lot of this offline. So you'd be able to build a lot of these golden ISOs on a laptop. You don't actually need to have a router handy to do most of this. So although the process you've described sounds fairly involved, it's actually not too difficult in real life.
Oh, absolutely. So the actual creation process is basically a few seconds. And the idea here is that you have to create an environment where you have some of the basic tools like the MKI OFS tool in order to package and mount the ISO before you're ready with the Golden ISO tool. So the environment that you need to create could be a base Linux system. It could be Ubuntu, Red Hat, whatever you need to be able to run the Golden ISO tool with its base dependencies. Or it could be a Docker image that we actually provide. So we have examples of a Docker image which has the Golden ISO tool inside it that you can launch even on Mac OS or...
you can run that anywhere that you can run a Docker image. Yeah, I guess I just wanted to summarize that and say, like, sure, this Golden ISO is a magic thing and you need to put it all together and test it and validate it, but you can do all that on a Docker container on your laptop, and you could even probably take it up a level and start using some sort of continuous integration pipeline to do it for you so that you could just keep repeating it over and over, I guess.
Absolutely. And let me actually harp on a couple of more points. One is that in order to deploy this image onto a set of routers, you would typically use either something like IPXE, as I mentioned earlier, or if a box is already running, you could even use the XR install processes to simply upgrade to the GoldenEye so that you specify. Right. So there are a couple of ways in which you can get the image onto routers within the network. The other aspect here is that think of what this is buying you. One, you're actually eliminating the ZTP process potentially, right? And you're directly getting the box to boot an image that already has all the state that you need.
Yeah, there's less back and forth now between, okay, I got to get an OS so I can talk to the rest of the world. And okay, now that I've got that far, I'm going to go get some more things. And then the risk of the scripts perhaps failing and so on. You've eliminated all of that.
Exactly. So this is basically trying to mitigate the potential failures that could occur in production when scripts, et cetera, are running. So you're basically getting to a stage where if the Golden ISO works on one device, and as long as IPXE or ONI works, this concept works across all devices, right? You actually don't need to worry about the fact that a ZTP script may potentially run perfectly on one device, but may fail for a variety of different reasons on another device, right? The image boots exactly the same way on every device. So the overall potential for failure is drastically reduced if you start using Golden ISO as a workflow in your deployment.
Well, Akshat, let's move the conversation along from Golden ISOs to model-driven ZTP automation. So we have in our conversations with Cisco and about iOS XR talked about Yang models, data models, and how they are referenced in a lot of the different automation that is being done on the platform for various customers. All right. It's not intuitive, obviously. It's not obvious to me anyway, where Yang models come into things when we're dealing with ZTP, because in theory, we're dealing with a naked box. How are their models there? So explain this to us. What are the data models that are useful for ZTP? Where do they live? How do we reference them? Give us the lowdown, man.
Let me describe the evolution that XR has actually gone through in terms of these model-driven APIs themselves. Maybe about 4 or 5 years ago, XR was primarily CLI-based, right? So that is the way any customer would apply a config onto the system. That is also the way you would get any operational information along with things like SNMP, of course. And therefore, CLI was your primary interaction point with the device. As we've moved on over the last 3 to 4 years, we've added a huge bunch of Yang models to the system as part of both the programmability initiative, but also, frankly, for any task you want to do on the system, whether this is provisioning through a configuration, getting operational state, or even telemetry that we've spoken about quite a few times. Mm-hmm. So the idea here is that if you have model-driven APIs available, how do you actually interact with them? And yes, there are different ways in which you can do this. There is NetConf, which most people would know about. There is also the fact that we've focused on gRPC as another RPC protocol mechanism that you can use to interact with these models. And some of the RFCs, I think RFC 7591, but maybe we can correct that, is the one that defines the JSON that would be used to actually interact with the Yang models defined within the system. And now we've also added GNMI as another way of, in a sort of standard way in which you can interact with XR devices and its Yang models. Now that all of these different utilities are available to actually interact, how do you do this on day zero? So a box boots up. As I mentioned earlier, a script can potentially run and try to configure the device. Now this script has to have some APIs available to actually interact with. When we first started with our work around the ZTP infrastructure, we enabled a large bunch of CLI APIs. Now, if you worked with tools like Napalm or NetMiko, et cetera, within the community, they have focused a lot on providing operations for CLI, such as merging configuration, replacing a given config, or doing show commands, et cetera. And we basically incorporated all of this, those capabilities as a core part of the API library that we provide for ZTP itself. So any script running on the system can potentially do any of these operations, merge, apply config, show commands, etc., as it runs on the box in the Linux shell, right? So this could be using Bash or Python libraries, or even as a binary that you've compiled for WRL7. And all of those possibilities exist. When you now consider the model-driven APIs, there is another dependency that is added. In fact, I would say there are a couple of dependencies added. One is that internally on the system, a netconf agent or server needs to run for netconf capabilities. And similarly for gRPC as well, a gRPC server needs to be instantiated as part of XR before you can communicate with it. And the other requirement is that your script itself should have all of the client dependencies required to actually interact with these protocols. So if you have a netconf script, a script that uses netconf to interact with the Yang models, then you will typically use libraries such as those required by NC client to communicate with the netconf agent on the box. Similarly, if you're trying to write a gRPC client, you will need the gRPC dependencies, depending upon the type of language that you're using, to be able to communicate with the gRPC server on the box. Now, in both of these cases, there are more dependencies introduced than you would typically deal with when you have to use CLI. In order to get around that, therefore, there are two things that we had to solve. One is that even though we've been saying for the last 3 or 4 years that Yang models are a first-class citizen on the system, you should be able to use Yang models for all configuration and operational data that you need, and it should work the same way as CLI. The only way we can actually claim that is if we are able to percolate those capabilities down to day zero by making sure that these services, such as the netconf agent server or the gRPC server, are started by default when the box boots up. So we've taken the first step in that direction. What's happening now is that the manageability capabilities, which we used to separate out into a separate package that included all the Yang models, netconf, and gRPC capabilities, is now going to be a part of the base image. What this implies, therefore, is that when the box boots up, all of the Yang models are prepackaged. In addition to that, you have to actually start the netconf server, right? So we have tied the starting of the server to an API that is provided as part of the ZTP framework itself. And we are taking it step by step. So first, we're focusing on netconf primarily, as I'll just touch upon, because it greatly reduces the dependency on the client side. But we will move to introduce gRPC on localhost pretty soon as well. Those are the two different protocol concepts that we will be focusing on in order to allow you to interact with Yang APIs as part of ZTP. Now, one other thing that I will add to this is that the client dependency, which I mentioned before, is critical to solve as well. You could potentially package all of these dependencies by creating your own binary off box, but you don't have to go through all of that hassle. Instead, in the Python library that we have for ZTP, we've actually provided a utility for you to use netconf calls without any transport whatsoever. This is actually quite unique. We are not going to instantiate any SSH port for a potential netconf client to connect to, because we don't want to start a port on any of the existing interfaces without a customer explicitly asking that port to be open. Instead, we are providing a binary on the box that is able to accept XML data, basically Yang encoded XML information that is consumed by the binary and directly applied to the system. And also it can respond back with a bunch of operational data that you might want to gather using those Yang models as well. So you don't have to rely on any sort of transport capabilities or third-party libraries to interact with netconf. And that greatly reduces the client side dependencies for ZTP.
Akshat, I think I got this here. So one of the things that I incorrectly went to in my head, the place I went was, we're going to be using models, but where do those models live? Because we haven't built the box yet. But in fact, we do have a base OS on the box, and this is an issue more of standing up the services that allow you to interact with those models. As you said, going after that first class citizen idea, as opposed to, okay, we've built the box, it's provisioned via traditional services, and now as an afterthought, we're going to go ahead and turn those services up for people that want to use them.
Exactly. So you basically have to have the server side running, and you have to have the client dependencies resolved. So how do you get to a state where your ZTP script is able to run and handle both without the customer having to potentially run a bunch of packaging techniques. Effectively, we are trying to make sure that on day zero, you start off with Yang models rather than having to depend on CLI on day zero and then only move to Yang models on day one. We can't really uphold our ideals of having Yang models as a native first-class citizen unless we actually invoke this on day zero.
And you're giving the customer a consistent operational experience right from, again, as you said, day zero and right into day one. You can work with models if that's your operational choice.
Absolutely. And one of the key problems that we've actually faced with customers in trying to move them from CLI to Yang models has been the fact that most of the change management that is taken care of on the customer front happens through CLI configurations. And this is for various reasons. One, either whether you use ZTP or not, you always use a CLI file to determine what the state of your box is. And you use that maybe through GitHub or wherever to actually do change management on the particular CLI state itself. So in order to move them to a state where they can start using Yang models, if you do this on day zero, I envisage people moving from static CLI files to static XML or JSON files that describe the state of the device in the form of Yang models. And that is the transition we want to make sure happens. Basically, ZTP can help trigger the transition to Yang models a lot faster than we would imagine.
All right. Now I want to talk, Akshat, about ZTP in access networks. That is, with a lot of ZTP deployments, you're owning the infrastructure. You're going to plug this thing into a rack, and it's all in a facility that you own where the DHCP servers and all of the images you need, everything's right close by, and it's a predictable way for that ZTP function to execute. But with an access network, you're shipping devices out to all over the place, potentially, building this network out where ZTP is much more challenging. How do you actually do that? How do you connect those devices back to your ZTP infrastructure and get those boxes provisioned? So describe this challenge for us a little bit in a little bit more detail. What do we mean by an access network? Typically today, how do service providers, when they're building an access network, actually get those boxes staged and sent off to wherever they're going? And then how can we do it differently with ZTP?
So the problem with access networks is actually multifold, especially when it comes to the idea of auto-provisioning these devices. When you consider access networks, I could be talking about, let's say, ring networks within a carrier Ethernet deployment or a mobile backhaul with a bunch of access devices that connect to mobile base stations, for example. And in any of these cases, the sheer number of devices that you're dealing with is quite large compared to most other deployments. The other aspect here is that these devices are potentially going to spring up along the roadside or on top of poles, for example, but they're not actually connected to a secured network as you would imagine a data center to be, wherein everything that you own, including the outer band network, is cut off from the rest of the network and therefore is something you can trust. And as we talk more and more about trust, I will get into security details as we go through this discussion. But to start off, let's consider the scale itself. For most of these service providers that are doing access side deployments, they typically use third-party installers in order to get the boxes to the installation site. And most of these third-party installers may not be adept at configuring and getting the device to the end state. What that typically therefore involves is that either you have to do a pre-staging facility where you will make sure that all the devices have the required configuration or, as we discussed earlier, have the required golden ISO on the box, and then allow these third-party installers to simply take the box to the installation site and power it on and hope that everything works. That's one way of doing it. Another way could be that if you don't have a pre-staging facility, you simply send the boxes to the installation site and then send an SME, CCIE, to be able to go to the site and then configure the boxes for you. Mm-hmm. Whichever technique you use, there is an OPEX cost that is involved, mm-hmm. right? You're either paying for a pre-staging facility or you're paying for SMEs to actually get your devices to the required state. So how do you actually reduce this OPEX cost by potentially removing the dependency on both of these entities? Specifically, when you're doing access side deployment, the number of devices is quite large. You are exponentially increasing the cost associated with each device. And therefore, in this regard, how can actually ZTP be used to get the devices to an intended state without having to involve way too many touch points? This is where I think the concept of sort of tree-based buildouts become useful. We have explored these concepts in the past as well. We had a concept called autonomic networking that used to do it for a while, but it turned out to be fairly academic in the way it used to do it. So we've tried to incorporate some of the concepts around autonomic networking and bring it back into ZTP, but do it using more of the standard protocols that we have. So in case of access deployments, therefore, you have to imagine that when a box goes out into the field, it is entirely possible that it has no access to an existing network with DHCP and web servers available. So you have to start considering what you need to do to actually get these devices to automatically fetch either an image or a ZTP script or config as part of their boot process. Now, the Golden ISO tool can also play a role here because you can actually reduce your dependency on the ZTP script side by forcing the device to do an IPXE and basically fetch the image that it needs with everything inside it. But keeping those artifacts aside, let's look at the tree-based build-out process itself.
Okay, well, just restate the problem again. You've got devices that are out in the field that you need to connect to some kind of ZTP infrastructure to get their configs and their images and all of that stuff. So yeah. with this tree-based strategy, I mean, I know you're going to get into it, but what we're actually doing, I think, is setting up a process where you can kind of build as you go, get one device that's an anchor to go back to provide access back to all those all the services that you need to do your ZTP, and then other devices in that access network that haven't been provisioned yet can use that anchor point.
Absolutely. So okay. there is at least one device which is in a location that it can have access to servers where the ZTP and IPXE artifacts can be downloaded from, right? So there is one device that effectively connects to the DHCP and the web servers. And this device becomes an anchor point for the rest of the devices, as you mentioned. And the idea is that when the next device comes in, the first device acts as a DHCP relay for the next device. Now, the next device, remember, has no direct access to the DHCP servers except for the DHCP relay, which is the first device. And therefore, upon getting the artifacts, say the image from IPXE or the ZTP script as part of the ZTP process, once it boots itself up, the onus is on the ZTP script that runs on the second device to make sure that the second device now becomes a DHCP relay for the third device. So in a sense, you're involving the ZTP script workflow to provision the devices one after the other as your entire tree builds out. Mm. Right? So this is completely independent of topologies. The first device is the only guy that is the anchor point and is connected to the set of services. But all the subsequent devices simply provision themselves as the access point for the next set of devices. So the devices simply connect to each other and bring up the entire network following the same exact workflow and depending upon the already provisioned device for access to the rest of the network.
Now, there's no out-of-band management network, so you can't use the management port to do this. You have to use this is all happening in line, right?
Absolutely. And this is actually quite crucial to understand. In most data centers, for example, you will have typically an out-of-band network that you can rely upon to make sure that these devices access a secure network with the same sort of LAN to work with for all the devices. This is on the access side. There are a couple of potential problems. One is that, yes, the devices, as I mentioned, have to do a tree-based build-out through the in-band production ports connected to each other. The second aspect is that a lot of the time, you will have VLANs over which these devices connect to each other or over a Metro Ethernet cloud that you'd expect these devices to send their probes on. In such a case, VLAN discovery is going to become an extremely important aspect of how we do provisioning for access devices. This is something that we're working on in the upcoming future because our focus on access devices and ZTP is going to increase. where we will look upon devices to do an automated VLAN discovery by sending probes across different VLANs until it receives the required DHCP packet. And once it receives that, it is then able to provision itself and then start provisioning the next set of devices in the tree. So you're basically going to incorporate VLAN discovery as part of the ZTP workflow, and that comes into our state machine of ZTP itself.
Now, is all of this functionality there today, or is this something you're testing with certain customers?
Right. So we have started trying this out with some customers. Some of these things are currently in development, and we're doing some back and forth co-development with customers to iron this out. But the idea is the same. We've done this before using autonomic networking that I mentioned earlier, but we're now doing this through ZTP using more of the standard protocols and trying to see how to get people to operationalize it for the large-scale access deployments.
Now, we really got to have the security discussion too, because thinking through this scenario where you've got these devices in the field that are connecting to your infrastructure from a distance, now there's a whole bunch of different opportunities to interrupt that supply chain in various ways, whether that's hardware, whether that's software, whether that's images. There's more opportunity for man in the middle and so on. Can we talk through what some of those challenges are and then a strategy to defeat them so that you know you're ending up with a box that you can trust?
Yeah, absolutely. So if you start considering the whole gamut of security issues that you can potentially have when devices go up into roadsides or on top of poles, etc., the sheer magnitude of the security issues is quite different from what you would typically encounter if you're running your own out-of-band network or you're running within a data center, etc. Within a given secure network, there are few things that you assume are always true. One, you're able to trust your LAN. You're able to trust the server that is providing the artifacts, such as the image or the ZTP script or config to the devices. And in all likeliness, you're able to trust the network devices themselves that you're trying to provision and get into the system.
Yeah, we do trust those things. Sometimes we're even right, and that trust is worthy.
Absolutely, right? But this is where it gets interesting on the access side. You have to start considering that if a device is going to go on the roadside or on top of a pole, it is entirely possible for an end user, or frankly, any nefarious user, to go in, take control of that device, and maybe replace it with a rogue device that tries to answer or make requests in exactly the same fashion that you expect your device to. And this is where you stop trusting the device itself that is trying to join the network. But in addition to that, think of man-in-the-middle attacks. You've put a device on the roadside, it sends out a request, and instead you go ahead and put your own device, a hacker goes ahead and puts his own device in the middle to answer back and maybe relay the information coming in from the actual DHCP server so that it is able to get the information that is being transferred in between the two devices. So in the end, whether you consider man-in-the-middle attacks or you consider
hardware attacks where somebody compromises the hardware inside.
Yeah. Mm. And in either case, you're potentially capable of losing out on critical information. Mm. Your configurations are extremely valuable, right? Whether you have pre-shared keys, like, for example, MACsec pre-shared keys, or you have simply IP addresses that you don't want to share with anybody else. All of this is possible if anyone is able to somehow receive that piece of configuration or even a ZTP script that connects to a bunch of other services and you're able to see what that ZTP script does, then all of this information is extremely valuable. So how do you actually secure the connectivity between the device that is going out into the field and the server that is providing the artifacts to the device? This is where we typically classify all of the different aspects of authenticating the servers and the devices into three categories.
Well, no, wait a minute, Akshay. Before we get into that, don't we just turn on all the security features that are inherent in a ZTP? Ha-ha.
Well, you're leading the witness, Your Honor. You're leading the witness.
I wish it was that simple. And in fact, you have to consider that security inherently is antithetical to convenience, right? ZTP is all about convenience. You're trying to automate how your device goes onto the network and how it is able to easily get to the required state without anyone touching it. But if you try and increase the security level, you increase the number of impediments towards complete automation, right? So, increasing security means you're reducing the convenience and vice versa. And hence, ZTP and security are very tough to make sure they go together. If you're trying to have a completely secure network by controlling the entire out-of-band network and trust everybody in the network, then that's exactly what data centers, for example, today are. And you're able to trust everything, and that is why you have controls on nothing. You don't actually even need to care about HTTPS downloads because you trust that the server running HTTP is able to give you everything you need. You're potentially even running everything in clear text because you know you own the network. So how do you get to a stage where you can't trust anybody and then try to introduce these security elements but don't want to jeopardize the actual convenience that ZTP provides you as part of the workflow? This is where the three types of validation that I was alluding to actually come in. One is client validation. The router is your client. It is trying to onboard itself onto the network. And therefore, in order to make sure that the router is exactly the one that you sent out into the field, you have to somehow identify the device with some attribute that you can uniquely tie to that particular device. So client validation basically involves the router itself relaying a cryptographic identity that is validated by the ZTP server that has to respond back with an artifact to the router.
Cryptographic, as in it wouldn't be good enough just to send a serial number or something like that. Could easily be spoofed. You need a cryptographic infrastructure so that you know the signature being sent is trustworthy.
All right. So when we consider client validation, we're basically thinking of a router, which is effectively the client that is trying to onboard onto the network. And we try to make sure that we're able to uniquely identify the device when it connects to the network and tries to request an artifact from, say, a ZTP server. This particular device, therefore, has to provide an identity which cannot just be a serial number. A serial number would be something that can be spoofed as long as you have another rogue device that behaves in a similar manner. Therefore, can we get to a stage where the serial number is effectively associated with a hardware root of trust in the device? And this is where we come to Cisco devices being unique in the sense that we have, in every modern device that Cisco provides that IIS XR potentially runs on, we have a cryptographic identity that is built into the device as part of its basic bring up. So you have a separate part of the hardware that actually does a couple of things. It acts as a hardware root of trust for a bunch of operations, including the boot up process, but a separate chip that stores the cryptographic identity associated with that particular device so that no one else can actually spoof it and it is not tamperable. And we use that to encode the serial number that can then be relayed to the ZTP server. So this is what we call a SUDI or a secure unique device identifier. And the SUDI is a unique way of identifying the router of the client going out into the field. So a ZTP server can potentially trust the router that is requesting this artifact and know that there is nobody else that can potentially mimic this particular field because this is tied to the hardware. This is not just a software relaying a random value.
And it's also a unique identifier. I know that Cisco has been putting this type of hardware in as part of preventing manufacturer fraud so that fraud, what the product that's coming to market is actually the product that customers bought. And so seeing this slowly be activated in the software for other purposes is quite useful, I think.
Exactly. And we are looking to make sure that we can start utilizing this hardware-backed identity for not just ZTP. Frankly, it could be for even controllers connecting through APIs, et cetera, in the future, right? So there are various use cases that you can involve this with based on your security considerations. If you now start considering, in fact, the next two stages that I'd like to consider is that I've already mentioned how the router that is onboarded onto the network needs to be identified and verified by the ZTP server. But the router itself could be subjected to a man-in-the-middle attack. Right, so a ZTP server could actually be a rogue device that is trying to respond back with some sort of credentials so that the router that is being brought up can be brought into the control of somebody else.
Yeah, so how does the router know? Now, it's been validated, but how does it know that the server it's talking to on the other end is legit?
Exactly. So how does the router, one, identify the server when it has nothing on it? And secondly, after that, how does it start validating the artifacts, which I'll just get into? So the router has to first identify the server. Now, the server, therefore, is supposed to be a part of the domain of the router, right? The router has to figure out that, yep, I'm supposed to talk to this guy because I can identify it with some particular certificate that I have on board. And there are various ways in which you can solve this problem, including a highly secure environment where you could potentially put your own certificate on the box during manufacturing or pre-staging, which of course adds to your OPEX cost, but it increases your security level. You could also potentially have manufacturing in Cisco do it for you, but these are all different techniques that we have to explore as we go into it and look at what customers are actually want as part of this process. But in the end, the device needs a customer identifiable certificate on it when it boots up. This is the only way server validation can actually function. So we are in the process of figuring out the process workflows required to actually make this work. But once the certificate is there on the router and it is basically owned by a particular customer, it will only accept a connection from a ZTP or web server that provides a similar certificate or certificate backed by the same chain. And this is where you start getting into a two-side validation, the server validating the router based on its SUD, and the device, the router itself, validating the ZTP server based on a signature that is backed by the same chain of certificates that it already has on the system.
But then there's still the problem of that third element, the artifacts themselves. So even if the client and the server trust each other, how do we know that the payload, if you will, the artifacts being delivered to the router, haven't been messed with in some way?
Exactly. And this is where it becomes really interesting. So on the artifact side, we can start leveraging everything that I just spoke about, particularly the hardware root of trust on the device, to actually start validating every artifact that you need to run on the system. So when an image is downloaded as part of IPXE, it's basically an ISO that needs to boot up on the system. And it could very well be an artifact that is relayed by a man in the middle, and is therefore something that can compromise your box when it comes up. It could be running a variety of different malware that you didn't expect. So in order to validate this, we introduced a concept of secure boot some time ago, and we continue to do that in all of the upcoming set of devices, which is very unique to Cisco platforms. We have a separate part of the hardware called the TAM, which basically is responsible for a couple of things. One, it helps secure the entire boot process by getting activated before the even the UEFI boot actually happens. So typically you would imagine issues such as boot kits being involved as part of the hack, where a device can be compromised even at the UEFI level, that is when the BIOS has to boot up. When that happens, you basically lose complete control of the device. Nothing that your software can do can protect you from a boot kit that's already been established on the system. So in order to prevent that, when you have a separate piece of the hardware that actually runs even before the UEFI boot can happen, then you have provided something really interesting. You can start validating the entire boot process, starting from the BIOS right up until the kernel and the user space boots up, to make sure that everything boots with an artifact that is verified. So if you have a Cisco device that already has a Cisco certificate already burnt in, an artifact is being provided that is signed with that same certificate, then you're able to go ahead and verify the boot of the entire device from the first time that the image comes in right up until it reaches the user space. So you're basically having, you're providing a system where your images are validated from the get-go. And this, therefore, even if you do not have a stage where, let's say, server validation is possible, and I mentioned that server validation involves potentially getting pre-staging activities in your environment, then in that case, at least validating the artifacts ensures that you're not going to boot something that doesn't come from a verified source. So that the artifact validation can be used as an initial stage of getting a fully secure ZTP deployment going without even having server validation in the mix.
Now, we mentioned at the top of this that ZTP isn't secure. That's the whole point of it. It's about convenience, and yet have talked through several different possibilities of adding security to the process. So what is the status of that? Are these things that Cisco is going to support for iOS XR customers, you know, as a unique proprietary feature? Would these be rolled in to standards, perhaps, for ZTP?
Yeah, so ZTP in its own right doesn't really come from a standards body. It is more of an adopted practice that the industry has been looking at for a while. But the components that are utilized, whether it's DHCP servers or the basic mechanisms for verifying identity or verifying the state of a particular artifact, are all coming from standard practices. It is basically a combination of them in a given state machine that Cisco brings to the table. So when you start considering the initial validation of the device at the hardware level and having a hardware root of trust, this is very unique to Cisco platforms, right? So specifically, this is of course not necessarily tied to iOS XR itself, and other OSs can do the same. But particularly when we talk of iOS XR, all of its platforms are meant to have these capabilities. Some of them already have it, the modern devices, and the ones coming up will definitely continue to involve these concepts.
Yeah, because the BIOS has to support IPXE and ZTP to be able to do that.
Those are the basic requirements for ZTP and IPXE to function. But in order to have a hardware root of trust, you have to depend on a Cisco platform. This is also why you would consider this as a differentiation with respect to, say, white box hardware. You would typically expect white box hardware to also start exploring these capabilities in the future.
And if you're listening to this going, well, surely if I just order a Cisco box or order whatever box, I get exactly what I ordered. Check the news, folks. There's been an awful lot of stories in the last few months about how hardware and the hardware supply chain can be compromised for nefarious purposes. It's a really legitimate problem. So Cisco tackling this is an important thing.
It is and it isn't. Like, it's theoretically possible. And it's one of those things where you want, if you're in a certain situation, you want to have assurance that the hardware that's in your network is actually safe and protected, and that's for customers that need that. But keep in mind that, you know, if you're in lower requirements, there's a balance to be struck here between the complexity of managing this technology, which is not insignificant, by the way, and getting the job done, and having a higher security posture, including validation of the hardware. So don't rush into this thinking that the world is falling. Take a measured approach, learn what you need to know, work out what the pain points are. Because Cisco's not going to love you if you're suddenly ringing up saying, I want this hardware feature because it's not quite there yet.
Yeah, fair point, Greg. And I didn't mean to go Chicken Little and say the sky's falling. I just wanted to raise that. It is a thing known that it is a legit concern that's out there in the wild, despite the potential rarity and difficulty of exploiting it. It exists.
And bear in mind that the reason we're even talking about this is because we're thinking of bringing ZTP to access side deployments. If you continue to do your manual installation of these devices as you do today, you don't necessarily have a concern. In that case, you trust the installer potentially. But when you have to automate the entire provisioning process, you have to start thinking about trusting individual devices in the chain.
Akshat, this has been a great and deep discussion on ZTP, zero-touch provisioning, where it's at, and where it is headed in the Cisco iOS XR world. Now, I know you guys have written up a lot of documentation, and there's publications and so on about these topics. Where can people go to find that information?
Stuff that we've been writing on XR has been going on to xrdocs.io. xrdocs.io, where you will find a bunch of different blogs and tutorials that we've basically written down so that people are able to actually get their hands on with all of the images that we publish, the software-only images, the virtual images, and of course, anything associated with actual hardware that they have in their labs. So we want people to actually get hands-on and dirty with these concepts, and we publish blogs on everything from APIs to CTP, etc. So go to exadocs.io and just bear in mind that we've actually changed the name for the ZTP sections. It used to be called software management, but it is now called device lifecycle. So look for device lifecycle on the exadocs.io page and you'll find what you need.
Excellent. And I'll just put in a plug here. I know I've done it before, but xrdocs.io is an excellent resource. It really is very well done by Cisco. If you're the kind of a person who thinks, most of the vendor stuff, their blogs and so on aren't really worthwhile, xrdocs.io is worthwhile. It's a good place to get some information, deep information, and lots of it that's there. And that brings us to the end of today's Heavy Networking. Our thanks to Cisco for not only being a regular sponsor, but also bringing expert guests like Akshat to talk nerdy to us. Keep up with all the different shows on the Packet Pushers Network by following us on Twitter and LinkedIn. If you only listen to Heavy Networking, you're missing out on shows like Network Break, IPv6 Buzz, and Data Knots. Find all of our shows on Spotify and anywhere else that you listen to podcasts. Last but not least, remember that too much technology would never be enough.